U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said progress had been made in negotiations with North Korea toward holding a potential summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump.
The conditions are putting President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un in a place where we think there can be real progress made by the two of them meeting. It does no good if we're in a place where we don't think there's real opportunity to place them together. We've made real progress towards that in the last 72 hours.
Earlier, President Trump told Reuters it may take more than one meeting with Kim Jong-un to seal a denuclearization deal. He also said he would like Pyongyang to dismantle its nuclear weapons program as quickly as possible under any agreement. Some American companies in Europe are not happy with President Trump's move to increase tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Europe, Canada, and Mexico. AP's Charles Deledesma has the story.
U.S. businesses in Europe appear dismayed by the hit on steel and aluminum imports from the EU. They're worried it could spark a trade war. Susan Danger, who's CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce to the EU, says American businesses in Europe are very concerned by the damage a tit-for-tat dispute would cause to the transatlantic economy and its impact on jobs, investment and security across the Atlantic. Meanwhile, the European Union's top trade official says it's a bad day for world trade. Cecilia Malmström says the EU did everything to avoid this outcome. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
U.S. Justice Department's National Security Division, created to combat terrorism, is increasingly focusing on an emergent menace, cyber threats posed by foreign countries from Russia to China. This is VOA News. China's militarization of man-made islands in the South China Sea will not scare off the United States, which is promising to continue carrying out so-called freedom of navigation exercises despite the rising threat. Marine Lieutenant General Kenneth McKenzie is the director of the U.S. military's joint staff.
We continue to seek areas to cooperate with China where we can, but where we can't, we're prepared to assert and protect both U.S. and allied interests in the region.
U.S. defense officials say China has been moving both surface-to-air missiles and air defense capabilities to islands in the South China Sea. Earlier this week, U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis criticized China's military buildup in the region. President Trump has reversed himself on why he fired Federal Bureau of Investigation Director Jim Comey. That story now from AP's Sagar Magani.
Days after dismissing Comey a year ago, the president told NBC he was thinking of this Russia thing when he did it. Today, he tweets, "Not that it matters, but I never fired James Comey because of Russia," saying the media loves to keep pushing that narrative, but they know it is not true. Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani told Fox News the president fired Comey because the FBI chief refused to state that the president was not a target of the Russia investigation. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Police have charged a man they say is seen on video shoving another man and firing a gun in a mandatory evacuation zone near the erupting Kilauea volcano on Hawaii's Big Island. No injuries resulted from the gunfire, but the victim, whose name was withheld by police, reported minor injuries from the scuffle. Meantime, Kilauea continues to spew lava. Hawaii County Civil Defense Administrator Talmadge Magno is expecting it to remain active for a while.
A lot of activity, so we're monitoring everything. All the operations are still working, and planning continues.
The volcano began spewing lava on May 3rd, forcing thousands of residents to evacuate. County officials say 75 homes have been completely covered by lava and roads have been made impassable. A 14-year-old has won the Scripps National Spelling Bee here in the U.S. Karthik Namani is the 14th champion or co-champion of South Asian descent in a row to win the Bee in its 93 years. This year's tournament had a field of 515 contestants, about double the competitors from last year. The money will receive more than $42,000 in cash and prizes. Get more news at voanews.com. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, the first day of June, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's president says the Trump administration is turning a blind eye on U.S. sanctions against Zimbabwe.
According to Mnangagwa, the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, known as ZIDERA, has been hurting the Southern African nation since it was passed nearly 20 years ago.
First reporter Sebastian Mofu in Harare. Angola expels over 50 DRC citizens. Flood-stricken Somalia needs more aid to avert a humanitarian crisis. LGBT communities in East Africa fight for rights and recognition. And Burundi's Constitutional Court validates results of the May 17th referendum.
He says that the court never found any irregularities during the referendum process and that the complaint made by the opposition coalition was judged as unfounded.
First reporter Moses Javier Rimana in Bujumbura and residents of Senegal's Casamance region to continue their years-long protest against a proposed mining company. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa says the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is easing enforcement of sanctions on Zimbabwe. The president spoke Thursday in Gweru, about 350 kilometers south of Harare, just a day after setting July 30th as the date for this year's presidential election. Sebastian Mofu reports.
In an hour-long speech Thursday to ZANU-PF party supporters, Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa said relations with Western countries are warming up since he came to power last November after his predecessor, Robert Mugabe, resigned under military pressure. Mnangagwa said the U.S. is overlooking sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe in the early 2000s following reports of human rights abuses and election rigging by the Mugabe regime. According to Mnangagwa, the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, known as ZIDERA, has been hurting the Southern African nation since it was passed nearly 20 years ago. He said that in recent months, his administration has secured billions of dollars in commitments to addressing Zimbabwe's moribund economy.
I must say this to you. My Americans, one is ZIDERA.
Americans have ZIDERA, which forbids U.S. companies to invest in Zimbabwe. But we have big U.S. company which came and wants to do Batoka Gorge hydroelectric project at about $5.2 billion. We asked them how they would do it when there's ZIDERA, and they said, Trump's administration is giving us a blind eye. So things are changing. U.S. embassy officials in Harare could not be immediately reached if indeed Trump's administration was overlooking ZIDERA, a law passed by the U.S. Congress in 2001. Turning to Zimbabwe's elections set for July 30th, President Mnangagwa said he was already planning beyond them.
We have agreed that the next 5 years after this election, we have programs we have put down to improve housing. We are saying 1.2 million houses to be built. We are attracting foreign companies who are willing to invest in houses as the industries are recovering.
President Mnangagwa pleaded for unity in ZANU-PF, which has experienced internal strains since Mugabe resigned last November. In the coming election, Mnangagwa is to face challenges from several opponents, including 40-year-old Nelson Chamisa of the country's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Burundi's Constitutional Court on Thursday certified the results of the country's May 17th referendum, which extends the president's term in office. The court rejected opposition claims that the results were invalid because the referendum was marred by intimidation. As Moses Habyarimana reports from Bujumbura, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza is now set to appoint a new cabinet.
The decision came on the final day of the nine-day deadline set by the Constitutional Court to deliver the verdict on the May 17th referendum. The Burundian opposition had asked the court to declare the results null and void on the grounds that the voters had been intimidated. But the court, in its ruling, said that the opposition leader's complaint was unfounded. Charles Ndagijimana is the chairman of the Constitutional Court.
La cour ne relève aucune irrégularité.
He says that the court never found any irregularities during the referendum process and that the complaint made by the opposition coalition was judged as unfounded. He says that the referendum process held on 17th of May 2018 was conducted in accordance within the laws of Burundi. According to the Constitutional Court and the Independent Electoral Commission, more than 70% of the Burundians voted for the 2005 constitution to be changed. The current constitution limited a head of state to run for more than 2 terms in the office. But the opposition coalition in Burundi says the recent referendum was not conducted in a free and fair environment and that most of the opposition supporters were intimidated and arrested. Agathon Rwasa is an opposition leader in Burundi and the deputy speaker of the parliament.
They cannot acknowledge that they are wrong with what they did. And yet they could do so just because they want to remain into power for life. So any means can be used by the ruling party and the regime itself. The electoral board, we know, has been appointed by the same regime. What can be the difference between that electoral board and the regime itself?
Pierre Celestin Ndikumana is an opposition member from the opposition coalition. He says that they are yet to get an official notification from the court on the verdict. He says that they deposited the complaints at the court but haven't been informed on any development since then, and that it is really a shame that this happened. He says that they are still waiting for a notification from the court on the final verdict. The new constitution will see the presidential term limits scrapped and also protects Burundians from being extradited to outside court for possible prosecution on crimes committed.
House reporter Moses Habyarimana in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Angola has expelled over 50 citizens of the Democratic Republic of Congo who had been living illegally in Angola. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai says some of those deported were found to be in possession of fake Angolan documents, including passport, voter card, and birth certificate. Also this week, Angola expressed interest in joining the International Organization of the La Francophonie. Meanwhile, President João Lourenço on Thursday ordered an independent audit of the country's $5 billion sovereign wealth fund, once led by the son of former President José Eduardo dos Santos. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai joins us now with more on these and other developments.
In fact, President João Lourenço ordered an audit of the accounts of the sovereign fund during the year of 2017. And according to decree published in official daily of the government, this audit must be promoted by an independent body. I must underline that last Thursday, the president's son, José Filomeno dos Santos, former main manager of the sovereign fund, was interrogated again by officials of the Criminal Investigation Service more than 8 hours in relation with his involvement of his businesses in the sovereign fund.
Mario, for the purpose of our listeners, how big is this Angola Sovereign Wealth Fund and why is it important?
It's really big. The Sovereign Fund was opened with more than $5 billion US dollars. It's supposed to manage the profits of the oil exports As you know, Angola is one of the more important African oil exports. But despite all these assets, there was a lack of transparency.
What can you tell us this report we are getting about Angola expelling over, say, 50 DRC citizens? What's behind that?
This is more or less business as usual. It was not the first time, and unfortunately, it will not be the last time. They were expelled by the Angolan Immigration and Foreign Service in the northern province of Zaire, across the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. According to the Angolan authorities, many of these illegal victims were found with Angolan official documents like Angolan passports, voter cards, and birth certificates.
Mario, before I let you go, what about this report earlier this week suggesting that Angola has asked or is looking into the possibility of joining the Francophone region?
Yes, in fact, a couple of days ago, when President João Lourenço met his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, in Paris, President João Lourenço himself said that Angola wants to be at least as an observer member of the international organization of the Francophonie. These developments comes out after a period of strong tensions in relations between the former colonial power, Portugal.
Mario, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you. And look, have a good weekend.
Thank you very much. For you too, James.
First veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai, he was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, the first day of June. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. The World Food Programme is calling for stronger international support for hundreds of thousands of Somalis impacted by some of the heaviest rains to hit their country in 3 decades. The rainfall that began last month has caused widespread flooding and damage in central, south and north Somalia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
For much of the last decade, Somalia has struggled with chronic drought. The 2011 drought was especially bad, killing an estimated 260,000 people. Now Somalia has the opposite problem, too much rain. About 1 month ago, President Mohamed Abdullah Mohamed appealed for international support to help hundreds of thousands of people displaced by heavy flooding. The response has been somewhat tepid. The World Food Programme says it is concerned the situation will become even more difficult since the disaster has slipped out of the world's headlines. The agency reports nearly 300,000 of the 700,000 people affected by the floods are homeless. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia says her agency is doing what it can to support livelihood and safety net activities to build up resilience.
But we are once again underfunded. We need some $120 million to assist the people in Somalia until the end of October. As you know, last year we were fighting to avoid a famine in Somalia. We have to keep on pushing to make sure that all the gains that we were able to make last year when we were able to fight off a famine can still be kept.
Earlier in the year, the UN appealed for $1.5 billion to provide aid to some 5 million people affected by drought and conflict. Less than $370 million, or 24%, has been received. UN officials say that isn't enough to support a robust flood response. Lucia says WFP is aiming to reach 3 million people in Somalia this year. She says work is going on in partnership with other agencies to reach the flood victims. She says the WFP is distributing high-energy biscuits and handing out 2 months' supplies of food rations in some areas. She says many places are inaccessible by road, so aid workers are using boats to reach people cut off by the floods. She says the WFP, which operates the UN Humanitarian Air Service, also has added a helicopter to its fleet to transport aid workers to flood-affected areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In most African countries, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender LGBT rights are either limited or non-existent. In East Africa, however, the LGBT community is rising to challenge homophobic attitudes and laws. Rael Ombuo reports from Nairobi.
This February saw the Kenyan LGBT community reach a historic milestone. A Kenyan court began hearing arguments in a case that seeks to repeal laws criminalizing gay sex. The laws were introduced in Kenya in 1897 when the country was under British rule. People convicted of a violation face up to 14 years in prison. Activist David Ochar says fellow activists are thrilled with the progress they are making, even though homosexuality remains outlawed and socially unacceptable in most African countries. Ochar says many African politicians use LGBT issues to distract people from bigger everyday problems.
Religion and culture has been used to scapegoat LGBT used as a scapegoat to either exclude, jail, blackmail, extort from LGBT individuals in Africa. And I think it's also a good way of the political class trying to, you know, cover up issues when there's a lot of corruption, unemployment, and issue with poverty, disease, and so the political class are not able to properly account to their citizens and to the electorate. LGBT issues are a hot cake. You simply use LGBT issues to divert attention.
In April, a Kenyan movie was shown at the Cannes Film Festival in France for the first time. But the lesbian-themed Rafiki, named after the Swahili word for friend, was banned by the Kenya Film Commission and Classification Board. Commission CEO Ezekiel Mutua explained why the ban was necessary.
Let me be very clear. Kenya will not accept homosexuality as a way of life. And I want to make it very clear before the media. I would rather lose my job than occupy a public office and allow homosexual groups and foreign donors to destroy our kids with that negative narrative. I will not.
LGBT rights face resistance in other African countries as well. In Uganda, the LGBT movement has been under severe pressure since lawmakers passed a law in 2013 to make same-sex relations punishable by up to life in prison, even though the country's constitutional court invalidated the law. In Tanzania, President John Magufuli last year slammed foreign NGOs that campaigned for gay rights. Raya Lombor, VOA News, Nairobi.
Community leaders and residents in Senegal's Casamance region say they will continue their years-long protest this weekend against a proposed zircon mine in the small town of Niafrang. Abdou Sen is a former member of parliament and an outspoken critic of the so-called proposed zircon mining plans.
We are going to gather all people who are against the project, and we are going to explain more for the understanding of people why we are against this project.
What are those reasons you are going to tell the people?
From this project, if we let this project be developed, what we are afraid, the uprising of water underground, because the dunes are tools which are preventing the water from the ocean to grow up underground. If we let them to exploit the dune, what we are afraid is that the water from ocean will come and we are going to lose all our ground, agriculture resources, water resources, and salt. All the bad things will come underground and we cannot do anything as an economy activities.
What is the current status of the zircon mines?
As you know, in our nation, corruption is very powerful. And even at the government level, some agree with us. But since some others are corrupted by Astron, the Australian company, the government cannot do anything other than to accept Astron to keep on exploiting the project.
But the project has not yet started.
Not yet, because people and many other people are against the project. But what I'm afraid is the government want to force by using forces, by using military soldiers, to exploit it. But it will be another question.
Do they have a date that they said they will start the project, or it's still not sure?
No, I'm sure that in these conditions, the project will never start. But after the election, at this moment, the president will not to take the risk to lose some voices. But after elections, I'm afraid they would like to force and to do what they like.
That was Abdou Sin, an outspoken critic of the proposed Zarkhan mine in Senegal's Casamance region. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the update on the injury sustained by Egyptian forward Mohamed Salah ahead of the summer 2018 Russia World Cup. The Egyptian Football Association on Thursday issued a statement detailing how its president, Hani Aburida, heard coach Hector Cooper and national team doctor Mohamed Abu El Ila travel to Valencia, Spain to observe Salah's treatment and rehabilitation in the Spanish city. The statement described the 25-year-old as having a determination to link up with his international teammates and added that for his part, Mohamed Abu Ella said that the period of absence of Salah due to injury will not exceed 3 weeks. Staying with World Cup preparations, African pair Senegal and Morocco drew blanks as the two World Cup-bound teams were held to a 0-0 draw on Thursday. For Senegal, their preparations began with a limp stalemate away to Luxembourg, although talisman Sadio Mane sat out the game, having only joined the squad this week after the Champions League final, where he scored for Liverpool in their loss to Real Madrid. It was the third successive draw for the Lions of Taranga since the qualifier for this month's tournament, and they now head to the Austrian Alps to train. Morocco, on their part, were held goalless by Ukraine in Geneva as they prepared to start their campaign against Iran before facing Spain and European champions Portugal in their World Cup group on their first appearance at the finals since 1998. Staying with Morocco, a Moroccan football delegation will visit Pakistan on Saturday to convince the Pakistan Football Federation to support it in its planned bid for the hosting rights of FIFA World Cup 2026. Ahead of the Egyptian vote on June 13th, Morocco has launched a serious campaign to convince the football world that they have the potential to host the biggest football spectacle in the world. There's a joint North American bid of Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., along with a Morocco bid. And now to boxing news. The Ugandan Boxing Federation has banned three of its top officials for 12 years, warning that any boxing club that associates with them risks getting the same penalty. Moses Muhangi, president of the Uganda Boxing Federation, told a press conference on Thursday that the General Assembly of the Federation decided to ban Fred Kavuma, vice president in charge of administration, former UBF trustees Kenneth Gimungu and Paul Ayasi, for what he described allegedly as bringing the sports into disrepute. And finally, in basketball news, the National Basketball Association and the National Basketball Players Association announced on Thursday that the NBA African Game 2018, the NBA's third game in Africa, will take place on Saturday, August the 4th at the Sun Arena at the Times Square in Pretoria, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, June 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you. I'm the king of the kuntu, and the loving the way I do this uncle. First, a 30-minute playlist of the continent's best music. Then, a live studio interview and music performance by Leni Stern Trio. Think award-winning female electric guitar player falls in love with West African griot music. Love. love coming to you this weekend. Don't miss it on Music Time in Africa, Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Yeah!
Thank you.